Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. President Obama met with Senate leaders yesterday to discuss possible replacements for retiring Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. The president said he hopes for an accelerated process and to have a new justice in place by the opening of the fall session. Joining me in the studio to talk about potential nominees, recent decisions, and upcoming cases, Jeffrey Rosen. He's professor of law at George Washington University. Joan Biskupic, she's Supreme Court reporter for USA Today. And Stuart Taylor, he's senior writer with National Journal Magazine. Do join us. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Call us on 800-433-8850. Join us on Facebook. Send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Joan Biskupic, talk about the president's meeting with senior leaders yesterday. Number one, who was at the meeting? What do we know they talked about?
Well, I think it shows that President Obama is now focused on the process. He met with, as you mentioned, Senate leaders. We've got Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy of Vermont. We also had Jeff Sessions, who's the ranking Republican, and then also Mitch McConnell, the senior Republican in the Senate, and Harry Reid, the senior Democrat, of course, in the Senate. And it was mostly just let's all talk generally. Let's look like we're going to be sharing information. The senators had already passed some names to the president. Everybody knows that the president's staff has been culling the records of various potential nominees for many, many months. This nomination battle was expected because John Paul Stevens had signaled he was going to leave. But this was the start, and it also offered a chance for President Obama to make a couple of comments publicly for the first time since Justice Stevens left. And what he said was that he wasn't going to use any kind of litmus test on social issues such as abortion. Now, this was in response to a question, I should say. Even though he was very strong about how he wants to take into account the person's position on individual rights such as privacy and the right to end a pregnancy, and he talked about the core constitutional values that he's looking for, it was all very broad language, but it did signal that he wanted to make sure the senator, anybody paying attention, that he was going to look for a broader view of the Constitution, including on abortion rights.
But Jeffrey Rosen, would you call this a pro forma meeting, or did it have substance?
It had substance in the sense that Obama was signaling that he is not interested in a nominee who can just dissent from the left and be a heroic kind of lonely voice. There's a lot of talk in the meeting and in the past week or so that what Obama wants is someone who can build consensus, who can appeal to Justice Anthony Kennedy the way Justice John Paul Stevens did. When you think about Justice Stevens' role as the senior justice in dissent, he was so skillful in cases involving gay rights and terrorism in appealing to Kennedy, and there's a real focus on the idea what the Democrats need right now is someone not just who can be alone, but who can be a consensus builder. Now, each of the candidates on the list has some consensus building credentials, so it's not as if this criteria would disqualify any of them, but it's a sign that the Democrats are really getting serious with trying to bring the court together.
So to what extent, Stuart, do you believe that President Obama is truly going to take into account the feelings of those on the right?
Well, I think a lot of this is for show. But, I think he will take into account the feelings of the right in the sense of being wary about nominating someone who's going to drive them nuts. But he doesn't need to have a meeting with Senator Sessions and company to figure that out. He can just, you know, read the papers or listen to his aides. So the meeting, I think, was largely for show. When he's actually making his choice, and he may have made it already, he'll be looking at a mix of things. Anyone who makes the left happy will make the right unhappy. You know, what balance of happiness between the right and the left does he want to strike? As to the appealing to Justice Kennedy idea, I think that is important, but I think it'd be a mistake to assume that Justice Kennedy is easily led by the nose by Justice Stevens or anyone else. And I think it'd be a mistake to assume that any junior justice is going to have all that much influence on any senior justice ever.
But when you say you think the president may have already made his decision, do you have an idea?
No, I wish I did. One hears that the early betting favorite is Elena Kagan, the Solicitor General. Well, the reason I say that is he thought about this last year, all the same people, or most of them. He's had a lot of time this year to think about it. I assume that he's not just deferring judgment until the day he actually names someone. The reason it will probably take until late May or mid-May to name someone has more to do with the timing of hearings and not wanting to give the Republicans an easy target too soon, I think, than it does with needing all that time in which to make up his mind.
What did he mean by the no litmus test? Was he talking just about abortion, or were there other issues, Joan?
Well, this was a very brief comment he made in response to a question on abortion rights. And as we all know, abortion is asked over and over and over at these hearings because of the controversy of the 1973 Roe versus Wade ruling and how abortion just endures as this difficult issue in America. I think he was just talking broadly. Mm-hmm. I don't think he was trying to signal anything too much more than that this is important to him and it will be important to him in his selection. But none of the people who are before him right now would do anything other than take the kind of view that he wants in terms of privacy rights.
I want to ask you about Elena Kagan, because there has been some talk from the right trying to disparage her standing, her reputation, her sexuality. Where is that coming from, Jeffrey?
I should say, first of all, that I've known Elena Kagan for many years. My brother-in-law is her deputy, Solicitor General, so I'm well disposed to her for all those reasons. But it seems like the recent controversy about sexual orientation was not an organized campaign, but a blogger on the CBS News website who carelessly floated rumors, incorrect as it turns out, about her sexual orientation. He later apologized for not having sourced them properly. But what made it into such a story was that the White House responded with what some thought was unbecoming indignation. They said this was an outrageous falsehood. They seemed to suggest that if she were gay, that there would be something wrong with this. And there was a debate about the debate about the debate about whether it was right to raise it in the first place. What should she have to say? What should the White House have to say? There's nothing to say except that we really shouldn't talk much about this. This has not been an issue for her. She's never discussed this either way. She shouldn't be forced to. But it says more about the right's anxieties about her positions about sexual orientation in general. And here there is a record. The real conservative case against her was that as Harvard Law School dean, she joined a brief signed by more than 70 law professors and by most law schools in the country saying that the Solomon Amendment, which denies federal funds to law schools that don't allow military recruiters on campus, was unconstitutional. As it turned out, the Supreme Court unanimously rejected this position, so it did not stand up very well. And once the Supreme Court rejected it, Elena Kagan said she was willing to respect the Supreme Court's decision. Mm. But the right views this as a sign of her excesses on these questions. The last thing I'll say quickly is that she hasn't been a radical on sexual orientation issues as Solicitor General. She did not appeal a Ninth Circuit decision striking down the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, but she has defended the Defense of Marriage Act. Basically, she's taking the government positions on these issues, as she said she would in her confirmation hearings. She doesn't seem to be a crusader on gay rights issues.
I just found myself wondering whether the blogger, whether he was put down or not, was an indication of how those who oppose President Obama may go after any nominee, no matter how high the standing, Joan?
Well, and I think, yes, the answer is there's going to be a fight no matter what. And that's what plenty in the White House are saying. So as they're thinking about who to put up, it's not a matter of do we nominate someone who makes it an easy set of hearings this summer and then we get a 98-2 vote and then everything just we fold up and we go back to legislative agenda. No, there's going to be a fight no matter what because these judicial appointments are so important and markers have already been laid down. It's been so interesting in the past, 10, 12 days since Justice Stevens announced his retirement, there's actually been no real news in terms of the selection process, but there's been so many stories circulating on the front pages of newspapers, but also all over the internet, the blogosphere, about who's up, who's down, who's gay, who's not gay. And I think that that's just the atmosphere we're in right now. One last thing about the don't ask, don't tell position that Elena Kagan took. That position that she took when she was at Harvard was embraced by so many academics. It was not a position that was outside the norm. It's just that in terms of the law itself, the Supreme Court said, no, the federal government had the power to do this and to cut off funding if you weren't going to allow military recruiters on campus. So it was fairly cut and dry, but it's the kind of thing that she was questioned about at her confirmation hearings for Solicitor General last year and that would definitely come up if she were nominated now.
Stuart.
I would add a footnote that law professors are supposed to know something about law. So when all of them go charging into the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court in essence says, you guys don't know anything about law, that's interesting. It doesn't say anything in particular about Elena Kagan.
You've never been in a faculty lounge, Stuart, I can assure you. Come over to GW and we'll set you straight.
As to the fight, being a fight, I distinguish two things. There's always going to be nuts out there who are going to attack from the left or the right. And there are always going to be some senators who are looking nervously over their shoulder at the nuts on their side and who will put on a show for that reason. I bet money there will not be a filibuster for various reasons, no matter who's nominated.
Stuart Taylor, he's senior writer with National Journal Magazine, contributing editor at Newsweek, and co-author of Until Proven Innocent. We'll take a short break. When we come back, your calls as well. And we're back talking about the announced retirement of Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens. A little later on, we're going to get to some of the cases the Supreme Court has recently decided, one most especially on animal cruelty, that a great many people are concerned about. First, however, I want to get to who's on the list of the most likely nominees to the Supreme Court, Jeffrey?
The most likely nominees seem to be the ones who were touted a few weeks ago. We've talked about Elena Kagan. The other two are Diane Wood of Chicago and Merrick Garland here in D.C. Diane Wood is a judge on the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. She is respected by conservative academics and conservative judges. She serves with people like Frank Easterbrook and Richard Posner, both of whom have touted her as a remarkably collegial colleague. They say that she counterpunches, that when they take firm positions, she is willing to stand up for her own views. She can sometimes bring them around to the liberal positions on questions like the protection of a mezuzah, of a religious symbol. But she is viewed as the most liberal of the three candidates because of her positions on abortion in particular. She was involved in a case involving abortion protesters, and the question was, could they be prosecuted under the federal racketeering laws? These were often violent protests. They intimidated women in abortion clinics. Diane Wood said that they could be prosecuted, and the Supreme Court ended up reversing her 8-1 and then unanimously. Mm. So her opponents will say this shows a kind of radicalism on abortion, which is, in fact, it was a First Amendment case. It's not really fair to tar her that way, but she has progressive views on civil liberties. She's talked about the courts in being in a dialogue with the rest of society, and but the fact that she's also supported by lots of conservatives would be a point in her favor.
And Merrick Garland.
Merrick Garland is here in Washington, D.C. on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, which has been a stepping stone to the Supreme Court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg came from there. Clarence Thomas came from there. John Roberts, Antonin Scalia. He's a male. And I think at this point, the administration is still thinking about adding another female to this court, where we only have 2 of the 9 justices being female. He was known to many people during the Oklahoma City bombing prosecution. He was in the Clinton administration, Justice Department, and took the lead on that. He's a very respected judge, again, like Judge Wood in Chicago. And he's someone who I think would definitely be in the mix, maybe not as strongly this time around when they might be looking for a candidate who offers a little bit more diversity.
At Stuart Taylor, the LA Times this morning is reporting that perhaps Judge Ann Clare Williams, the first African-American ever appointed to the U.S. Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, might also be on this list.
That's correct. And the list is up around 10 of, in terms of other people who have been mentioned. Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm, former Georgia Supreme Court Chief Justice Leah Ward Sears, also a black woman, Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano, and some others. I think the original three, who were described very aptly by my colleagues, Elena Kagan, the Solicitor General, Diane Wood of Chicago, and Merrick Garland, are still the most likely. I wouldn't discount Garland quite as quickly for that crippling white male disability that he has. He is universally regarded as the easiest to confirm of this group and as the one who would attract the least opposition in the Senate. And if the president thinks that's a priority, that's important. Also, both Garland and Wood, I think it's impossible to understate how impressive their credentials are as judges, both of them. And he's a moderate liberal, she's a liberal, but the reviews of both of them by their fellow judges, by lawyers who appear before them, have been uniformly glowing. Now, the one little problem with that is that the court now has 9 people who were former federal appeals court judges, and if one of them is on the court, why then Senator Patrick Leahy, for example, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, keeps saying, let's get someone from outside the judicial monastery. Well, maybe that's one reason these other people are being discussed.
How much has the court changed ideologically in the last decade, Joan?
Well, it certainly moved to the right. Just think of what we've had since Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor left in late 2005, early 2006. Chief Justice Roberts is a more active conservative, has been more effective, I think, in the center chair. And Justice Samuel Alito, who succeeded Sandra Day O'Connor, is more conservative than she was. So we've had this rightward shift. We've had a real difference in terms of the approach to the law. They're all, as my colleagues have said, former appeals court judges. They're all very, very good on the law, skilled in interpreting statutes and looking at things from the point of view of a judge, but they don't have the kind of broader lifetime experience that we might have had a couple decades ago. And they also, as I said, have marched more to the right. And what the Obama administration would like to do is sort of reverse that. Justice Sotomayor, who succeeded David Souter, was at best a wash, liberal for liberal, and some people even say that maybe she might be slightly more conservative than he was on criminal justice issues.
And there's a real question, as a result of the rightward shift that Joan aptly describes, about what Democrats want out of the court right now. There's this remarkable irony that after years of accusing Democrats of being judicial activists, of running to court to reverse their political defeats, now it's Republicans who are doing precisely that. The second the health care bill is signed, Orrin Hatch, who fought against it in the Senate, joins a lawsuit challenging it as unconstitutional. The same thing for campaign finance. Mitch McConnell loses the congressional battle and persuades the Supreme Court to strike it down. And now financial regulation is going to come before the court, and the Obama administration will pass control boards and regulations, and those will be challenged as unconstitutional. And the question is, can the Democrats find a nominee who will embrace this old tradition of judicial restraint that says battles should be fought politically, not in courts, national laws should be deferred to? Can they paint Roberts and Alito and the conservatives as the activists basically turning their rhetoric against them? And I think that's going to be at the center of the confirmation hearings. And we're going to hear a lot from the Democrats, people like Al Franken, who's been so strong on this, and Senator Leahy, that we want an economic populist, someone who's really going to defend economic justice at a time when the Supreme Court is striking down campaign finance regulations. This is going to be a big issue, more than abortion.
Stewart, what has to be in place for a justice to have a real impact on the court?
Well, to really change the court, the justice has to be much more liberal or much more conservative than the justice who's retiring. That's not going to happen this time because Justice Stevens, just turned 90, who is retiring, is as liberal as anyone on the court, and most of the people being discussed to replace him would be no more liberal than he is. Now, of course, they'll be there a long time, but President Obama won't really be able to change the direction of the Supreme Court unless one of the four conservatives or Justice Kennedy, the sort of the sometimes conservative, sometimes liberal, retires. This is important. It's interesting. But no matter what happens in this summer's confirmation process, the direction of the court will not change significantly.
And, you know, it takes time. It takes time for a justice, no matter how much judicial experience came before, to settle in, to win the respect of colleagues, to move up in seniority in terms of the ability to suddenly have the power to assign opinions. And I think the man who's leaving, John Paul Stevens, is Exhibit A in that regard. He certainly had two careers. The first one, when he came on in 1975, was much more as a middle of the road, more conservative than, for example, William Brennan and Thurgood Marshall. But after those senior liberals left, he really took charge and took much more of a lead and arguably moved to the left himself. So we don't know what this new individual will do on the court, and probably only in time will he or she, Stewart,
I apologize for daring to suggest that a white male should be considered.
No, you don't. No, you don't. All right, let's turn to this recent Supreme Court decision regarding banning animal cruelty videos. Jeffrey Rosen.
What an interesting decision this was. This is an 8-1 decision saying that a law that makes it a crime to create or sell dogfight videos or other depictions of animal cruelty violates the First Amendment. And Chief Justice Roberts, right, he says this is a prohibition of alarming breadth. The government's defense is startling and dangerous. Essentially, this law was passed to ban so-called crush videos. It's a particularly horrific fetish involving the, I won't even say it, you're holding your ears, but it involves the killing of animals.
I've never seen one of these, but I've heard about them. You've seen them, Joan?
I did, just for my job. I felt like I had to go watch these videos. I mean, I've got this darn job I had to, it's awful. You don't even want to, your listeners will not appreciate the fact of kittens and other small animals being crushed in these terrible situations.
But it's not important to describe the details because the law was so much broader. It prohibits not only the torturing of animals in this horrific situation, but depictions of animal cruelty, which are illegal where the video is made or bought, not necessarily where it's sold. So you basically could have a picture of someone hunting a deer in D.C., which is illegal in D.C., sold in Montana where it's not illegal, and that depiction would violate this torture statute. So it was drafted in a very sloppy way. And what's so important legally about this is that Chief Justice Roberts says, we're not going to create new exceptions to the First Amendment. The government, the Solicitor General's office, had argued that you have to balance the First Amendment interests against the government's interest. Roberts said, absolutely not. We're going to be strong protectors of free speech. And in this sense, the decision is very much of a piece with the campaign finance decision, protecting the speech of corporations, and perhaps with an important case the court will hear next week involving the anonymous speech of people who are signing petitions in Washington involving gay rights. If you sign the petition, should your name be disclosed? What one thing we're seeing on this court, and this is part of Chief Justice Roberts's promise to bring the court together, the one thing they are agreeing on, not in campaign finance, but in this case and perhaps in the next one, is that the First Amendment is really important. That transcends ideological boundaries. It's quite a libertarian court on free speech issues.
Stewart.
I think that's right. And I think I'd emphasize what Jeff said about the breadth of this law. The example he gave, bullfight videos might in some circumstances be barred by this. Now, the core conduct that Congress said it was after, which are the crush videos, which are so horrifying and disgusting that you don't really want to describe them, it's interesting to think whether they could come back, Congress could come back, pass a new law that says, okay, we're not going to have it be so broad this time. We're just going to go after that central horrifying conduct, whether that might pass muster. And I think it possibly might.
Okay, here's the part I don't get. Crushing animals is an illegal activity. Killing a creature in such a way as is depicted on these films is illegal. Is it not, Jeffrey?
It is.
So why should a film showing this occurring be legal?
Because this is a depiction of cruelty. It could even be a cartoon that impersonates the cruelty, or in some places, killing an animal is not illegal, and it would still be illegal to film that.
Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington University, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And joining us now from his office here in Washington, D.C., is the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, Wayne Pacelli. Good morning to you, Wayne. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Wayne, give us your reaction to the court's opinion in U.S. v. Stevens.
Well, I think some of the discussion of your panel is really the problem with the court's reasoning on this. The application of this statute was extremely narrow. First, we had this law was so successful in essentially driving these crush video producers and purveyors out of the business that after it was enacted, we couldn't even find these videos, whereas before the law was enacted, we found 3,000 separately produced animal crush videos. So this was a tremendously powerful and effective law. The only application in the decade that it was around, it was enacted in 1999, passed by a Republican Congress and signed by President Clinton, was for the sale of dogfighting videos. Now, dogfighting is the most severely and widely criminalized form of animal cruelty in the country. There are 50 state laws that make it a felony. There's a federal law that makes it a felony. There's a federal law that bans the interstate transport or possession of dogs for fighting. That was the only application of the statute. And I think Justice Alito had it just right in his dissent. He was the only dissenter, unfortunately. But the court just went with these crazy hypotheticals. The Congress was very clear that this was aimed at the most egregious killings of animals that violates state and federal laws for animal cruelty. And it was really about crush videos, and it was really about dogfighting. It was never about cartoons. It was never about bullfighting. It was never about hunting. And the congressional record is absolutely clear on this. And the solicitor for the Bush administration, the Obama administration, made that plain. And I think that this set of hypotheticals just went wild. And there's no one who is going to be prosecuted for cartoon depictions or any of that. I mean, it's just a fanciful notion. It's just not a real-world concept.
So tell me what you see the Humane Society doing now.
Well, I want to remind listeners that judicial decisions have real-world implications. When the Third Circuit overturned this statute, the Supreme Court took up that appeal, we saw the web repopulated with these crush videos. We did a report in October. There are hundreds and hundreds of these crush videos. Dogfighters are making videos. And I think it's very important to note that these acts of vicious and malicious cruelty are staged for the purposes of production. And that's just like the 1982 Ferber case with child pornography, that even Justice Roberts said it was the inseparability of the sale of the material and the underlying violation of the law. So Congressman Elton Gallagher, with a host of Democrats and Republicans, reintroduced a bill yesterday, H.R. 5092, that has the prohibition on the sale of videos apply just to these malicious acts of animal crushing. I personally believe that the animal fighting activities can also meet the test because it is so widely criminalized. We hope to pass it, and I hope that we just stop this fanciful set of hypotheticals because it's leading, unfortunately, to the invalidation of a legitimate, defensible statute that is really doing real work to stop these horrific acts of cruelty.
All right, Joan.
You know, this is a perfect example of how what happens in real life is not what sometimes will matter at the Supreme Court. And I know this can sound awfully cold, but the view that the Humane Society advocates here was really only embraced by Justice Alito. He struck a lot of the same chords as Mr. Pacelli, saying, look what's really happening out there and look at what this is about. It's not about all these fanciful hypotheticals. But here's the thing that was important about this case and why it got so much attention. The Solicitor General in some ways overplayed her hand by saying we want a special category for animal cruelty that would exempt it from the First Amendment. Chief Justice John Roberts called that idea startling and dangerous, looked at it totally from the First Amendment framework.
Joan Biskupic, Supreme Court reporter for USA Today. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By Ann and John Herman, supporting the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching, at breakthroughcollaborative.org. And by Lee and Stuart Rolfe, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation for their support of NPR programming. This is NPR.
Pulitzer Prize-winning biologist D.O. Wilson's first novel. It's the story of a boy transformed by an improbable love of ants. He risks his life to save their pristine habitat in the wetlands of Alabama. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour.
Thank you.
And just before the break, we were talking about the Supreme Court's decision on the showing of animal cruelty in videos. The court ruled that this is part of free speech and therefore should be allowed. Everybody on this panel can see how upset I am by this decision, which to me makes no sense at all, especially when you compare it, Jeffrey, to the court's ruling on child pornography.
All right, Justice Ream, I'm going to try to persuade you. It's going to be a tough argument, but here we go. First of all, Your Honor, this is not like child pornography because, as Chief Justice Roberts said, child pornography is a special case. The market for it is intrinsically related to the underlying abuse. Whereas in this case, the demand for hunting depictions is much bigger. You might have a demand for magazines or videos showing hunting, but that would be a crime in D.C., so a hunting magazine would be illegal. That's the difference with child pornography. Second, the hunting magazine example shows it's not just crazy hypotheticals about cartoons. You can actually have a lot of YouTube videos of hunters engaging in activity that's legal in one state and illegal in another that would be banned. And the final thing to say is that Congress can fix this. As Mr. Pacelli said, they've already introduced a law that Chief Justice Roberts said would be permissible, limited to crush videos and other depictions of extreme animal cruelty, which the court would uphold. And remember, the First Amendment is always for people we hate. I mean, the great cases involving the rights of Ku Klux Klan speakers or of people who burn the flags. I mean, you're not supposed to be sympathetic to these speakers. They're the least popular speakers in our society. But if the First Amendment means anything, it's freedom of speech for those we hate. And the fact that all the justices, except for Justice Alito, Justice Ginsburg, Breyer, Stevens, Sotomayor, these are civil libertarian justices, join this, should reassure you, Your Honor, that they would not have joined if there were not a very strong First Amendment
and
case against it.
And there is another counsel in the room. Go ahead, Joan.
Right. And what the government had said in from your position was the Supreme Court should look at the societal costs, balance the societal costs against the value of the contested speech. And that was another argument that Chief Justice John Roberts, with the help of seven of his colleagues, rejected out of hand, said, no, again, the First Amendment already presumes that it's going to be a kind of speech that we don't like that has cost to society, but that's not why we're going to reject it. This was a very muscular opinion on the First Amendment, reinforcing the idea, again, just because it's offensive, just because we all turn away, is not a reason for the government to want to regulate it that way.
Diane, may I chime in?
Certainly.
Thank you. You know, we're not talking about speech, and I don't think anyone was conveying any ideas in these videos. It's just not speech when you have a child molested and then sell the video of the molestation. And when you're crushing animals and impaling them and otherwise torturing them, there's no speech there. There's no speech in dogfighting videos where animals are biting each other to death and they're dying from hemorrhaging and other forms of slow torment. There's no speech here. This is commercial conduct. And I think that's the point of Congress. That's why 26 state attorneys general signed on to this, and while you had solicitors from both the Bush and Obama administration. Again, this has nothing to do with hunting. The word hunting is not mentioned. The measure is clearly designed to get at widely criminalized illegal conduct in the United States of a very cruel and malicious nature.
Stuart.
The hunting issue has never come up.
Okay. The statute doesn't mention the word hunting. But as Chief Justice Roberts emphasized, it does use the word kill. It does use the word wound. Well, when you hunt, you kill things. And although these hypotheticals may be fanciful in the sense that the Justice Department hasn't prosecuted anything like that and probably won't, if you read the words of the law, not the legislative history, not what they said they wanted to do, you read the actual words of the law, which is what the Supreme Court does when it's dealing with First Amendment claims, they are hugely broad, and all of the hypotheticals we've been talking about, fanciful or not, could be prosecuted the way that law is worded.
Well, you would also have, if that were true, then you would have all sorts of prosecutions at the state level of hunters and many others under the anti-cruelty statutes, because all of the anti-cruelty statutes use that same sort of vocabulary. And I think this is where we get, you know, prosecutorial discretion. I mean, not every statute is going to give absolute clear guidance in every possible fanciful scenario. And that's why we have judgment exercise, and that's why we have courts. And I think that this statute and its application was very precise. And again, there were no prosecutions for crush videos because the market evaporated after the statute was enacted. And the only category of prosecutions were dogfighters, which is the most widely and severely criminalized form of animal cruelty in the country.
All right. I'm going to open the phones to hear how a listener in Greensboro, North Carolina, feels. Good morning, Scott. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a quick question and a quick comment. I just wanted to ask your guests what the real world applications for this statute would be. I'm an avid bow hunter, and in my state, our deer population is well over a million. And you know, proper animal husbandry is we have an unlimited harvest season. And so, since it does have the words "kill," you know, what are the real world applications for this decision? And thank you. I'll take my comments off here.
All right, Jeffrey.
Well, bow hunting is legal in all 50 states, and I think it automatically is exempt on that, not only because of its legality, but Congress explicitly exempted all sorts of activities for educational, artistic. I mean, there's a whole litany of terms that are in the exception for this statute.
All right, Jeffrey Rosen.
The Chief Justice convincingly said that those terms, the exception for serious religious, political, scientific, educational, journalistic, or artistic value, couldn't save the statute. He said most hunting videos are obviously not instructional in nature, except in the sense that all life is a lesson. And if Scott were engaging in hunting that is legal in his state but illegal in the District of Columbia because he wanted to express himself and show his support for hunting as a central aspect of his identity, and posted that on YouTube, and that were downloaded in D.C., or he made a magazine about it that was bought in D.C., that would be illegal. And that's not fanciful. It would be a really chilling effect on his performance art as a hunter who wanted to stand up for hunting in his state.
I can't think of one hunting. I check all the hunting magazines, the hunting websites. There's been, within the last 11 years, the most robust sales of hunting videos you can imagine. And, you know, again, this is just, I'm sorry, it's an ivory tower examination of the issue and not a real-world application.
All right, to Fulton, New York. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning. I was just wondering, are snuff films also protected by the First Amendment? Both snuff and crush videos would be a depiction of something that's illegal, so I was wondering if it's okay to watch people killing people instead of people killing animals.
Joan.
No, in fact, first of all, obscenity already is exempted from the First Amendment. Child pornography, since I think 1982, has been exempted from the First Amendment. So there are specific categories, specific categories where the Supreme Court has said it doesn't have the same kind of First Amendment coverage. What the government here wanted was to add depictions of animal cruelty, and the Supreme Court drew the line.
All right, Dan, one more call on this subject. From Kento, Ohio. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Earlier this year, the Supreme Court ruled that it was okay to censor video of U.S. troops torturing people in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and places like that. And I just wonder, what is the reasoning? How does that reasoning compare to the crush decision? I mean, why is it okay to watch animals being tortured but not okay to watch people being tortured?
Stuart.
I don't believe the Supreme Court did rule that. There was a case in which, involving the Freedom of Information Act, a suit by the American Civil Liberties Union, that was before the court, but then Congress came in and passed a law that basically mooted the case and ended the case and said that the Freedom of Information Act did not require that those photos be made public. So the Supreme Court never really decided anything.
All right, we're going to move on to other issues. Wayne Pacelli, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Wayne Pacelli is president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. All right, let's go to Kathy in Orlando, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. My question, or actually statement, about the Supreme Court is that as far as electing an individual, about talking about other nationalities that are also a possible candidate for the Supreme Court. You have John Echohawk of the Paiute Nation. Rapid City ran an article yesterday. You have BuffaloFire.com, a blog writing about John Echohawk, USNews.com writing about John Echohawk and this possibility of Supreme Court, and also Indian Country Today, also, you know, the push to get John Echohawk for the Supreme Court.
All right. Thanks for your call, Joan.
Well, you know, it's interesting that the court has a long history of just being, you know, white without a lot of ethnic diversity. In fact, when Justice Scalia was named, he was the first Italian-American in 86. Sonia Sotomayor was obviously the first Hispanic just last year. Right now, of the candidates who really seem seriously in the mix, you don't have that kind of ethnic or racial diversity. And again, I'm just talking about what's coming in terms of serious signals from the White House. I think that there would be some interest not only in the first Native American justice, but obviously in the first Asian American Supreme Court justice. And names like Harold Koh, the former dean of the Yale Law School, have sometimes been in the mix. But there's no one who seems to be really in front runner status at this point. And that's just kind of the reality of the sorts of names that the White House has put out.
A couple of other cases. Jeffrey, you mentioned the Doe v. Reed case. Tell us about that.
Doe v. Reed is very interesting. The question is whether Washington State's open records law violates the free speech rights of people who sign ballot petitions by requiring their names to be made public. And here's another case where the First Amendment people are on every different side. The New York Times filed a brief arguing that petition should be public records, but the ACLU says that this openness could have dire consequences, likened gay rights activists to Nazis. There must be no place in our democracy for brown shirts seeking to force their way through thuggery and violent intimidation. Here's what they're afraid of. Essentially, you remember the Prop 8 trial that's going on in California, the question of whether there's a right to gay marriage in California. Some people who signed petitions for the California Supreme Court decision to be overturned were then identified. They thought they were going to be anonymous, and they lost their jobs as a result. And they said, this is a core example of chilling our political speech. We're opposed to gay marriage. We should be able to do that anonymously. And similarly in Washington, the fear is that if you can't sign petitions anonymously, you might not take unpopular positions. Big implications for campaign finance, too.
Jeffrey Rosen at George Washington University. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And what about the so-called peekaboo case? What's that all about, Joan?
You're bringing up a case that's already been argued, and we've had a couple of exciting ones out there that we're waiting for opinions on. And I'll mention that one and then also the gun rights one that I think a lot of your listeners have been following. The so-called peekaboo case involves a public accounting board that was set up in the wake of the WorldCom and Enron accounting scandals a few years back. And the acronym sounds like peekaboo. But so that's why people call it that. And the question is the makeup of that board. And a question of separation of powers, whether President Obama had the authority to appoint and not remove members of that board. So that's a good ideological litmus test that we're waiting for. Another case that we're waiting for that has a little bit more sexier appeal to some of the listeners involves gun rights again. The Supreme Court is looking at a case from Chicago that will test whether the individual right to bear arms that they established in a 2008 case for the federal enclave of the District of Columbia would also extend itself to local and state gun laws and let individuals assert a Second Amendment right there. So these are cases that have already been heard that we'll probably see in the next couple of weeks.
All right, to Daytona Beach, Florida. Louise, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you. Right-leaning Supreme Court recently decided that corporations could spend unlimited funds for campaigns. I believe they were trying to undermine average income voters like myself, who gave donations in record-breaking numbers in 2008 to Obama's campaign. And speaking for myself, I believe we will give generously again in 2012 to President Obama's campaign. But It's very obvious that this Supreme Court, especially Roberts, was trying to give corporations the upper hand in our election process.
Stewart.
I actually was quite critical of that decision for, I think, the reason Jeff hinted at earlier. It just seems to me corporations aren't people, and the money that's being spent does not belong. It belongs to the stockholders who didn't really decide they wanted it spent that way. However, I don't think it's going to have that huge impact, nor do I think that was the reason for it. Remember, unions as well as corporations are unleashed by this, and I've spoken to some political
experts. What's the proportional difference?
Well, of course, they haven't been giving money in the past, but I've spoken to some political figures, and the corporations have a lot more money, but I think the unions have been more interested in spending what money they have on political causes than corporations.
A lot less than corporations have.
Well, I've talked to politicians who think it might help Democrats as much as Republicans. Beyond that, I don't think many corporations are going to spend much money in this way.
The counterargument is that they might feel that they have to, that essentially if you've got to pay to play, Exxon might think that if they don't give to both sides, then they're really not going to be competitive. And that's why Congress's proposal to require disclosure might be important. Imagine if the CEO of Exxon had to say, after an ad for Drill Baby Drill, I'm the head of Exxon and I support this ad. There's an example where disclosure might actually be a way of promoting accountability.
Joan, last word.
I think that was an opinion that is going to be on center stage during the hearings, and I think that President Obama's invoking it during his State of the Union recently has set the stage for him to keep bringing it up and bringing it up because it really resonates with the public.
Joan Biskupic of USA Today, Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington University, Stuart Taylor with National Journal Magazine. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.